You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday the 27th of December 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, we have a Radio Albion roundtable on tonight instead of Real Britannia. We've got an Albion Narrations tomorrow, another Albion Narrations on Friday. We don't have Patriotic History this week, but we do have a live stream from Patriotic Alternative on the Friday night. And we also have another Radio Albion roundtable to fit in at some point. We do have the Audio Insurgency for this week, and we do have the Orthodox Nationalist for this week, and we do have the Nefarious podcast this week as well. So keep listening out for Radio Albion content. We will have the same number of new podcasts out as we normally do over this week. But to get into the news for today, and this is really related to what we were discussing on Friday, myself and Grandpa Dan, about Omicron in Denmark. Over the weekend, I got a text to my phone demanding that I get a booster dose of the vaccine, and shouting at me in capitals, "Get your booster dose now." And I should imagine a lot of people were probably concerned about that. And I expect most of our listeners here use pay-as-you-go phones, so your phone is completely anonymous. So how on earth do they know that that's your phone, or that you haven't had a vaccine? And I think they just pretty much sent it out to every mobile phone in Britain. That's what it looks like to me anyway, because I don't see how they could actually work out whose phone is whose and who has had a vaccine and who hasn't had a vaccine, because your medical records are private. And I believe that that text would have originated with the government. We got some news here on Omicron as well. A study has found that even an unvaccinated person who has never had COVID and has no immunity has a 10% lower risk of being hospitalized with Omicron compared to Delta. For someone who has been recently infected, the chance of hospitalization was slashed by 69% in both vaccinated and unvaccinated people. So really, what is the point in being vaccinated if your chance of hospitalization is exactly the same whether you've been vaccinated or whether you've been unvaccinated? And this data came in just moments after a similar study conducted in Scotland found the risk of being hospitalised with Omicron was 65% less than with Delta. So the forecast that we were making last Friday appeared to be holding up, that Omicron is much less harmful than Delta. And we also have a UK Health Security Agency analysis, which has given grounds for optimism by suggesting people with the fast-spreading Omicron variant are 70% less likely to end up in hospital. And in South Africa, they were 80% less likely to end up in hospital. So why are we having all these restrictions in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, and probably likely in England later on today as well, when Boris Johnson gives his speech? I'm actually recording this at lunchtime. The research also revealed that immunity from boosters fades much more quickly against the new strain compared to Delta. And I mean, why would you need boosters? If this was a vaccination, like all the other vaccinations, you're vaccinated and that's it. You're vaccinated for life. So why is it that people are needing to have boosters of this this what we're told is a vaccination. I mean, it's gene therapy is what it is. It modifies your genes. It's completely different to all vaccinations that we've had before in the past. This is a brand new technology that they have here that they're calling a vaccination. Those who received two AstraZeneca doses plus a Pfizer or Moderna booster have 60% protection against Omicron for 2 to 3 weeks after the third jab. No, not even 2 to 3 weeks, just 2 weeks after the third jab. So you have 60% protection for 2 weeks. After 10 weeks, it drops to 35% for Pfizer and 45% for Moderna. So after 2 months, basically, it's dropped down to just 35% protection that you have. The new study shows that for those who received two Pfizer jabs, effectiveness against Omicron is around 70% after a Pfizer booster, which then drops to 45% again after 2 months. So what you're talking about there is people are going to be needing to have six of these jabs every year, just in order to have 60%, 70% protection. And yet we're told that the unvaccinated have a chance of up to 70% anyway. Just if you're unvaccinated and you've actually had the virus, you've got the same protection as somebody who needs to be jabbed every 2 months, according to this information. A Moderna booster on top of two initial Pfizer doses pushes the effectiveness up to 75% for 9 weeks or 2 months. Is it really worth this risk? I mean, I heard today that there were four professional footballers that died yesterday of heart attacks. I mean, we're hearing of heart attacks going all around the sporting world. We're hearing of divers that can no longer hold their breath for the amount of time that they used to be able to. We're hearing of children that are having strokes and heart attacks, swollen hearts, all these sorts of things that children should not be getting. And I do fear that the more jabs somebody has of this new technology, the more likely it is that they're going to suffer from these side effects. Why is it that they're hiding the information about this? Why is it that Pfizer have blanked out all the information of the dialogue that they had with the government about this? And why are they only releasing the information on it at a rate which will mean that it was going to take 50 years to actually produce all the documentation that was involved with this? I've seen a Romanian politician pointing this out. He asked to have a look at the EU contract with Pfizer to find out what was in it. And he was handed the contract, and it had all black markings all the way through it, so you couldn't actually read what was in there. And this is a public contract. And as he pointed out, if you have democracy, it's supposed to be clear and transparent. You're supposed to know what is going on. I mean, this information that I've just brought to you today, this comes from the Daily Mail. So it comes from a reputable source. But of course, it's buried in one of their other articles. But it does look anyway as if Omicron is much weaker than the previous versions of the virus, and it does look as if these vaccinations, these booster shots, are going to need to be done every 2 months just to give you the same amount of immunity that you would have if you had caught the virus and beaten it. And of course, if this virus is so much weaker now, this Omicron version, then really you want people to catch Omicron and build up a natural immunity to it. And apparently 90% of the country is now vaccinated. So why are they pushing to get the other 10% vaccinated? All you need is 90% of a population to have an immunity, and you've got herd immunity there. So what's the game here? Why are they pushing to get everybody else vaccinated? I fear there is a sense of, well, we've done this and we know it's harmful, and why should you get away without taking the risk and doing the harm to yourself as well? I think there may be an element of that in it, certainly amongst people that have been vaccinated and have then found out these issues with it and are wishing that they hadn't taken it. And I think there is some resentment there that there's a group of people that didn't take it and haven't taken these risks and haven't harmed their bodies in this way. It's a sad state of affairs, but it's not really the sort of subject that we talk about here at Radio Album. We try to concentrate on ethnology, but we also have to talk about current events as well. Moving on to another news story, a completely different topic here. In what was the largest analysis of ancient DNA that has ever been done, it was discovered that two large migrations of people into Britain that were previously known first started to take place around 6,000 years ago. Their ancestry was mostly from a group known to archaeogenetics as early European farmers, with around 20% from a different group who are referred to as Western European hunter-gatherers. This migration led to the replacement of most of the existing local hunter-gatherer ancestry. So what we have here is confirmation of the sort of stuff we've been talking about on our patriotic history series about white people coming into Britain from the Near East, particularly in search of tin. If it wasn't for the tin, the large amounts of tin that there is in Cornwall, there never would have been a Bronze Age in the Near East. So we were certainly connected up with Babylon and Iraq and all these early centres in the Near East, and they were white people. And this is where this migration into Britain and into Europe actually came from. And what they're looking at here, it looks like there were three migrations in all. The first one they're saying is 6,000 years ago, so that would have been around about 4,000 BC. I mean, I would make a guess that it was probably nearer to 3,000 BC, maybe a little bit later than that. Looking for the tin, as I say, looking for the resources that there were in Britain. And about 4,500 years ago, just at the beginning of the Bronze Age, a second migration took place, which saw descendants of livestock farmers from the Pontic Caspian steppe, grassland that spans from present-day Bulgaria to Kazakhstan. Ancestry from this group ended up forming at least 90% of the genetic makeup in Scotland, England, and Wales. And what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that the people that were living in what we now know as Kazakhstan and all the way through to Bulgaria were white people, because the people living in Scotland, England, and Wales are quite clearly white. And this Pontic Caspian steppe, that's where the Aryans moved down to. They moved to the east and went into India, and they moved to the west and they came into Britain. It says here, it is believed that people from England and Wales today have more ancestry from early European farmers than people in the early Bronze Age did, which suggests that a third migration from Europe may have happened more recently. And of course, what they're pointing out here is they're just saying, oh, well, these people came in from Gaul and they came in from Europe. But of course, they came into Europe from somewhere else in the first place. They didn't just spring up out of the soil in Europe. They moved here. They migrated here from the Near East, which is where the centres of civilization were. And this third migration happened around about the time that we had the empires of Israel. We had the time of Israel living in the area where they are now, but also Syria and Lebanon, and they were in that part of the Mediterranean. They were known as the Phoenicians, and it was the Phoenicians that made their way into Britain, picking up the tin. We know about that because it's talked about by the Greeks. And we also had this other movement that came into Europe as well, the Scythians and the Cimmerians, that came into Europe from an area which is partly sort of Persia. It's up above Assyria there. And some of those Scythians headed off to the east and went into India, and they brought Buddhism with them. And some of these Scythians headed west, and they then became known as Saxons. And they also became known as the genuine Scythians, the Germain Scythians, which is where we get the word German from, and it's also why our ancient British history books referred to Germany as Scythia. So these Scythians actually became Saxons. And this research here really does seem to confirm this, because it talks about this migration that also came into Britain on top of these two previous migrations. It says here they found evidence of a third mass migration into Britain from France that took place between 1000 BC and 875 BC. And I would say that it went on right the way through that, from 1000 BC right the way up to AD, pretty much. There were people that were coming in from France, but the people in France were the same as the people in Britain anyway. The people from Gaul used to be educated in Britain, in the Druidic universities. We have Julius Caesar that tells us about this. It says here that in this time between 1000 BC and 875 BC, this was the time that early European farmer ancestry increased from around 30% to about 36% on average in the south of Britain by the late Bronze Age. During the Iron Age, this stabilized at nearly half the ancestry and populations of England and Wales. And they just tell us this. Oh, it's nearly half the ancestry of the populations of England and Wales. They can't actually tell us that, because they don't have all the bodies of the people that were in England and Wales at the time in order for them to assess their ancestry. What they have is a few bodies, and then they try to make a guess from that. So they don't actually know what the population was and how many there was of one group and how many there was of another. What we do know is that the group that was actually here, the humanoids that were here in Europe and in Britain up to about 6,000 years ago, and these were people that had been around in Britain from, I don't know, thousands of years back before that, they were completely replaced. They died out, basically. They were either wiped out by the incoming white people, or they were expelled from there. We don't actually have people around today that were the same as the people that were here before then. Ian Armitt, who led the study, said, "We have always known this period of the Middle and Late Bronze Age was a period of tremendous connectivity between Britain and Central and Western Europe." Well, what we actually know, but they won't tell you, these academics won't tell you, is that we weren't just connected with Central and Western Europe, we were connected with all the civilizations in the Near East. We were connected with China, even. We were connected with India. We have the Urumqi mummies in the Tarim Basin, which is the beauty of Lulan. You can look that up, and you'll see that we have a Caucasian white woman that was buried in the Tarim Basin, in the salt basin there, which preserved her body, and she was there 4,500 years ago. And she was white, and the clothing that she had was the same clothing that we find in Northern Europe. The clay vessels that they had there are the same clay vessels that we have in Europe. I believe the corded ware culture, we call it. So it shows that this woman was part of that same culture, and from then we find lots more Caucasian bodies there. We don't actually find the Mongoloid body type until, I think, 1000 BC or 500 BC. So for 1,000 years out there, it was white people. And that was a trade route. And they were working their way through there to China and to India. And they were white people. Surely they were connected up with the white people that were in Britain. And remember, Britain had tin. Nowhere else had tin. There's no tin in the Near East. And you have to have tin in order to make bronze. So there had to be a connection to Britain for there to be any civilization at all in the Near East. And the people that were in Britain, they were pioneers, and they were people that were coming here to get the tin and then send the tin back to Phoenicia or Assyria at the time. And then Assyria would sell it on to Babylon and Iraq and all of those civilizations there. But all these academics today will tell us, they'll just say, oh, we were connected to Central and Western Europe, because they don't want you to know that there were white people all over the world. But I mean, it just makes sense. And they sort of ask, well, what was it that could have been driving this migration? Well, white people's drive to discover new lands and conquer them and build civilization there. That was the drive. But the first drive was to just look for the resources that they required and that they didn't have in the Near East. This Ian Armit says, prior to this study, we would have thought of the movement in terms of individuals and small groups, traders and people looking for metal. But the results show society was far more mobile than we thought. Large sectors of society were on the move. Societies were very interconnected across the English Channel in a manner we hadn't really appreciated before. And that just shows you that the, you know, these blinkers that they have, because if you look at the ancient histories that were written by the Greeks and the Romans, they talk about Britain. The Isles of the West, the Isles of the Sea are talked about in the Old Testament. They were connected up with Britain. And when you look at the map of where the tin resources are, there's some small tin resources, I think, in Iberia, maybe a few more possibly in Bulgaria. Nothing like the massive tin resource that we have in Cornwall. We found ingots in Israel from, I don't know what it was, 1000 BC, something like that, showing that we were connected up with them there. We were not just connected up with Central and Western Europe. The rest of the world was known to white people at that time. The findings may have helped to settle the argument about when Celtic languages were first spoken in Britain. Mr. Armit said the most established theory based on the analysis of ancient object styles is that Celtic languages came in during the Iron Age with Celtic speakers from continental Europe. And I believe that these languages originated in the Near East. If you look at if you look at the English language and the way that it's written, it's quite clear that it goes back to Phoenician writing. And you can see that runes go back to there as well. There's a lot of similarity between the runes and Phoenician. And where did the Phoenician come from? The Phoenician came from the Assyrian. He said, the new evidence suggests Celtic languages came to Britain earlier than first thought, in the middle to late Bronze Age. And of course, Welsh has a great similarity to Hebrew as well. And if people want to look up the information on that, they will be really surprised, because they don't actually include Hebrew as an Indo-Aryan language, and they should do, because Welsh is very similar to Hebrew. Analysis of DNA, of course, does not reveal what language someone spoke. And again, this is the problem. They make these guesses and say, oh, these must have been the Celts. They must have been speaking Celtic language. But they have no idea, of course. Also intriguing is the new study's finding that there was a rapid increase during the Iron Age in the frequency of a gene variant for digesting raw milk, something that is commonly known as lactose tolerance. And it's actually a different spokesman here, because I'm now quoting from a different article on this. Tom Booth said, it remains rare in Britain until the middle of the Iron Age, about 2,500 years ago. It's incredibly recent in evolutionary terms. In order for it to have gone from nothing to almost everybody in that period of time, your ability to digest raw milk must have been life or death. Well, the beauty of Lulan, who was buried in the Tarim Basin around about 4,000 years ago, they had lactose tolerance because they knew how to make cheese. They knew the technology that's required for making cheese. You have to add rennet to it in order to actually make the curds turn into cheese. So they had this lactose tolerance 4,000 years ago. They were Caucasian. They were white. Why doesn't it make sense that the same people that were in Britain would have had this as well? He says, adding to this whole craziness to some extent is that it becomes common in Britain 1,000 years before it becomes common elsewhere in Northern Europe. Again, and that's because these people were in Britain, the same people that were in the Tarim Basin and that were in the Near East civilizations. I'm not sure that the sort of people that they're referring to that were elsewhere in Northern Europe at the time, or why he thinks that they didn't actually have this lactose tolerance. I mean, if you read the Vedas, you look at Indian history, And the Indians were originally Aryans, and it's all about butter and cows and milk. It's quite clear that they had a lactose tolerance because they honoured butter so much. And these books, the Vedas, are supposed to go back 2000 BC, 1000, 2000 BC, so 4000 years ago. They had it over in India. I think all white people have this lactose tolerance. So I don't know why they're saying it didn't become common elsewhere in Northern Europe. Maybe it is actually that people themselves didn't actually become common elsewhere in Northern Europe. If you look at what the Greek historians had to say, they said that Europe didn't really have anybody living in it apart from on the coastlands, because it was all forest land and there was no civilizations here. There were like outposts where there were mines, and in the Baltics where they were going there to pick up amber, wherever there were these resources, there were outposts where miners and workers would go to pick up these resources that needed to be taken to the Near East. But they didn't actually have cities here and universities and all of that for quite some time. Only in Britain, we do know in Britain they had universities by the time of Julius Caesar. They had 30 or 40 different universities and cities that had grown up around these universities, and all the aristocracy from Gaul was being educated in Britain. So they didn't have these things in Gaul. They didn't have them in Northern Europe apart from in Britain. And that was because Britain had this tin, so it was the first place to be colonized. He added, one of the leading possibilities is maybe that Britain went through a period of catastrophe like a famine or difficulty acquiring clean water sources. Then what raw milk does is supply you with a clean source of hydration and food at the same time. Potentially all you need are cows or sheep, and you can make it through a disaster like that. Well, I don't think it just suddenly evolved out of a need for it. I think the people that came to Britain already had this, because they had this in the Near East. The mass movement of people to Britain took place against the background of similar upheaval on the continent, which to some extent homogenized the genetic makeup of Europeans. In this period, there is a convergence of ancestry throughout Western and Central Europe, said Professor Reich. I think what happened was there were just more people coming into Western and Central Europe from the Near East and from Asia Minor. We know that blue eyes and blonde hair, it came in from Asia Minor. Asia Minor is joined up with the Fertile Crescent, and that's where these civilizations were. In general, though, there were exceptions. Northern populations become more genetically similar to southern populations, and the southern populations become somewhat genetically more similar to the northern populations. And that's basically because it's all the same people. It's all white people. And when you have a group of white people in one area and they end up staying in that area instead of moving away, then you have natural selection and certain traits get selected for, and you end up with a group of people that are their own nation. I mean, that's how nations arise. They start out as clans and tribes, and then they eventually become nations. And even though they're all white people, all the European nations are white, they all have a unique look to them. I mean, the Scots look slightly different to the English, and the English look slightly different to the Welsh. And if you go to countries in Europe, you notice that the people there look slightly different to us. I'm sure we probably all look the same to Chinese people or black people, but when you're a white person, you're a white man, and you go to these countries, you notice that there are these subtle differences between the white nations. There are effectively different breeds. That's what nations are. They are different breeds. And as these clans came in from Near East and they settled, then that clan had the chance to grow into a nation. And that's where they came from. And if you are interested in this sort of stuff, then I do recommend you check out our Patriotic History series that we have on Friday nights here at Radio Albion. This week we have the Patriotic Alternative live stream instead, but Patriotic History will be back Friday week, basically, with a new episode on the Phoenicians. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I will be back not tomorrow, but I will be back on Wednesday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.